and welcome to episode 47 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm here with my energetic co-host, Perry Middleness. You feeling energetic today, Perry?
Not too bad, thank you, David. Not too bad. We had a bit of a fairness function yesterday to celebrate the 70th birthday, belated 70th birthday celebrations for our good friend Kerry Hanfield. Hello, Kerry. Wave to Kerry. That was a lovely afternoon. I had a few glasses or large glasses of beer, and I was a bit slow to get started this morning, I will admit. I'm feeling better now. Once I get up and get going, I'm all right. So energetic enough.
Enough.
How about we say that? Just enough.
Fair enough. All right. Well, it was pleasant to be able to have that that get together yesterday, because things were a bit easier in terms of these restrictions we've all been under. So that was great. Came in on the tram wearing a mask the whole time, but that was all right. That's fine.
Okay, well, that was good. We caught up with a number of people that we'd hadn't seen in a good 12 months, sometimes even longer.
Yeah.
Purely on the basis that, well, sometimes you just weren't even allowed to go anywhere near them because of the 5 kilometre radius limit that we had in our lockdown in the middle of last year. And other times you just haven't caught up with them for 12 odd months. So it was a good get together. It was a good day. Everybody seemed to enjoy it, and we all had a decent time.
Jolly good time.
All you could ask for.
Indeed. All right. Well, this is going to be a little bit of a strange episode in terms of how we put it together. It's a bit of a dog's breakfast, I suppose. But
we're all got dog's breakfasts. I had thought that I should have done this a couple of episodes ago when I first mentioned the Hugo nominations, but I'd neglected to look up at the deadline. So the Hugo nominations have to be in with the Hugo administrators by midnight March 19th Pacific Daylight Time. I have no idea what that is. I think it's something like UTC minus 7 hours, but how that relates to our time, I don't know. But let's say March 19th sometime, so there's only a couple of weeks to go. People who would be thinking about this, I'm not sure if they, many of them have. I've put my nominations in, but I haven't put nominations in every category. I've only put them into the ones that I feel comfortable about putting something into. So novel, fan cast, fanzine, a few other bits and pieces. I haven't really gone hell for leather with a whole lot of stuff. And I can still update it. I've still got 2 weeks to update it. So the good thing about it is, with the software that they have at the moment with the Hugo nominations, is that you can put your nominations in for any number or up to 5 per category. And you can just leave them there. A month later, you can come back and change them, delete some, add others, add to other categories if you like. And so you can just keep building it up. And it works incredibly well. It stays there. It keeps your most recent nomination. When the top deadline comes, all over, all finished, and whatever you've got in at your on your nomination form at that time, that's the way that it goes. And seems to work pretty well. I've got 4 novels, I think, but I haven't got any of the short fiction in. I've read a few novellas recently, and maybe I'll add one of them in. But I'm not overly keen on most of them. And I think we've also had this discussion previously that when I actually want to nominate for the Hugo Awards, I do nominate purely science fiction, fully aware of the fact that fantasy awards are also eligible. And when it comes time for the voting, I will read all of it as best I can to give myself a chance to be able to vote properly. That's fine. It's just the way that I do it. Other people can do whatever they like, and I'm not telling them what to do. This is just purely and simply the way that I go about doing it. And it'll be interesting to see what comes up. I did actually make a bit of a change to that hard and fast rule about science fiction. I did actually nominate Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, because I think it is an excellent book, and it deserves to be on the ballot. As to whether it's going to win or not, who knows? But I think it deserves to get the recognition to be on the ballot. So that's up, and that's going, and that'll be finishing up in a couple of weeks, and then it'll probably be a month, anything up to a month or 6 weeks, for the final ballot to be made available. So that will be mid-late April, and I would think that the voting will finish sometime mid-late July. They do pretty well. They give you a good 3 months to get through it. And as you've stated in the past, David, if you're a supporting member of the convention, this year's convention, which is the one that's going to be in Washington, D.C., you will be able to vote for the Hugo Awards, and you will also, if it becomes available, get a copy of the Hugo Voters Packet, which will give you a fair slab of the fiction nominees. Maybe not all of them, but it will give you some excerpts, but sometimes you will get the whole lot, and it's quite good value, worthwhile to be staying in touch with and keeping on rolling with. So that's what I'll be looking forward to coming up, and that'll also give you an indication about April, May, what it is I'm going to be reading. So you can pretty much tick it off for me at that point.
Well, this is the reason to nominate all the works that you've actually read, so that you don't have to read them again, you see.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, that's a good point. I haven't really thought of it in that sort of nefarious way, but actually it's not a bad way of looking at it. But also, it's just a matter of these days, when I've got a bit more time, I can pick and choose, buy the books as e-books, so it's cheaper. I don't need to worry about having the house full of paper more than it already is.
Yes.
And it gets me the opportunity. So I've got the time and the possibility of being able to do it, so why the heck not?
Sure.
Just carry on and do it. So it's all good fun.
Yeah,
it's all good fun.
Indeed. All right. I thought what we might do, as I said before, there's a number of different things we're going to do with this particular episode, so it might be a little bit all over the place. But the first thing I wanted to do was that Perry in the past has talked about a couple of things, a book and a TV series, and mentioned them briefly. And at that stage, I hadn't read either the book or watched the TV series, so I didn't sort of have much to say. So I'd like to go back to those, and we'll talk about them in a bit more detail. So the first one is a book called The Women in Black by Madeleine St. John. I'm saying St. John, it's spelt St. John, but apparently, according to Bruce Burford in the introduction, she pronounces it St. John. So we'll go with that, Madeleine St. John. So this is one of those books which are rather deceptive, I think, deceptively good. On the surface, if you heard about this book based around a group of women working in the ladies' frocks department of a big store in Sydney during the 1950s, and you were told that nothing much very dramatic happens to any of the people in the book, you'd probably think, oh, that's not my kind of thing, and you'd give it a miss. And that would be a pity, because it's a delightful book. It's full of a whimsical understanding of human nature. And the writer has a real ability to create interest in these characters and the lives of these fairly ordinary people. And there's this sort of gentle humour behind it all. It's lovely. So just a very brief recap of some of it anyway. So one of the main characters that the writer focuses on is a young Leslie. She's a girl who's just finished her school leaving certificate. So she's probably 15, 16, something like that. And she's waiting for her results. And like a lot of young kids did in those days, certainly they did in those days, and I suppose to that extent they still do a bit. She's been applied for a temporary job during the Christmas holidays, and she's got this job at the F.G. Good department store. I wasn't sure if that's a real place. Was it? It was actually a historical place.
Or, I don't think so, but I think it's probably fictional.
Based on one of those things.
One of those Sydney-based ones, like Foy's or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, really, it's the book is a sort of coming-of-age story for this young person, and she doesn't like the name Leslie, so she tells the staff that her name is Lisa, and rather than Leslie, and she has hopes of getting good enough results in her leaving certificate to get her a scholarship to attend university. Though her father, as you'd imagine in those days in the 50s, isn't very keen on the idea of her going to university and having to pay for fees and so on. Anyway, during her employment at the store, she really comes of age, she blossoms and she gains in self-confidence. And she's greatly helped along by someone called Magda, who's a refugee woman who dominates the exclusive model gowns section of the department. There's no point in sort of trying to encapsulate the whole plot of the, as such, if there is a plot to it. It's just a really delightful, it's a delightful book by an Australian author who I hadn't encountered before. It was first published in 1993, but only recently it's been turned into a film by Bruce Beresford, who was a fellow student of Madeleine St. John's at Sydney University, along with such eminent names as Robert Hughes, Germaine Greer and Clive James. Quite an amazing group of people who were at the University of Sydney at that stage. Amazing. Anyway, I haven't seen the film, but I certainly like to. So, yeah, I thought it was a great book. Lovely book.
I really gave it a very high score. I think a 4.6 out of 5 or something like that. I just thought it was spectacularly good. I had picked it up because it was, well, lying around. My wife had raved about it, thought it was tremendous. She liked the film. She saw the film first, loved that. Went and read the book, also liked that. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try to see what it was like. But as you pointed out, it wasn't really overly tempting, you know.
No, it didn't sound like it'd be a tempting
book. It didn't sound like
it,
but it's glorious. It's just wonderful. And the style of this woman's writing is just astounding. There is one section that I pointed out in one review I wrote about. It's about this Hungarian refugee, Magdalene, throws a party for the people that she knows and for her... her co-workers in the dress department of this department store. So they all go back to her flat, and it's all sort of European style in terms of the way they do things. And so all of the Australians are like shocked that, you know, they bring out a sort of a charcuterie table or platter, and they bring out bits and pieces. It's not a big meal, it's just pieces, and they drink champagne and they just have a fantastic time. But this whole party is encapsulated in about 4 to 5 pages of this sort of statico prose about, and it's all based on what Magdalene's doing, about how she's getting this person to talk to that person and making sure that everybody is okay and that everything is in the right place. It's a fantastic piece of work. And a 4 to 5 hour party encapsulated in 4 to 5 pages is just wonderful. But she's just a really, really good writer. And for this to be her debut, even though I know that she was probably in her 50s when she wrote it, is astonishing. It's just come out of nowhere. And she only wrote another 3 or 4 books.
There's another 3, I think. Yeah, I'm going to
follow 3, which is really quite sad. But a lot of them are available from text publishing now. I know that there's another one that we've got in the house that my wife is currently reading, and she says it's great. She says this next one is absolutely really good. So this will be somebody that we'll be following up. Every now and again you come across particular writers that you find just hit the mark for you. Another one that I remember from way back when was Penelope Lively, who won a Booker Prize in the early 1990s or late 80s. And she's also another one of those that's an astounding writer that every time you pick something up by her, it just shines. Penelope Fitzgerald is another one. Yes. Very short novel. She also won a Man Booker Prize, called Booker Prize way back then, and a couple of other books which are really quite short but just glow. And it's good to pick up these little extra books every now and again that you come across, and suddenly it sort of reinforces your faith in the fact that somebody can write a good thing without it going 500 pages and being absolutely turgid. You know, it doesn't need to be. You can do something that just shines. And while, as you say, there isn't much of a plot to this particular book, it's all about character and it's all about time and it's all about Sydney and its surrounds in the late 1950s.
In that era, it's very much about the era,
In that era, and it's just perfect. I mean, I didn't live there at that time, but I've now got a pretty good indication of what it was like. It's really, really very good.
That's good. Yeah, I the reason I picked it up was... I'm a big fan of Hilary Mantel, who wrote the trilogy I talked about Thomas Cromwell. And I saw that she had raved about it, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll go out and buy a copy, and I'm very glad I did. It was good. So yeah, it was good. All right. The other piece of media, I suppose, that I wanted to talk about that Perry's mentioned a couple of times is The Umbrella Academy, which is a TV series. It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original. And I had resubscribed to Netflix recently in order to for my wife and I to watch Queen's Gambit, which we did enjoy a great deal. But when I saw that this series was also there on Netflix, The Umbrella Academy, and I remembered Perry talking about it, so I decided I'd have a look at it, and I ended up binge-watching two seasons of it. So it's based on a comic book, not one of those from DC or Marvel, but the independent group Dark Horse Comics. And actually, out of interest, I went out and bought the first volume of the comic, which is a very quirky graphic style. There's quite a lot of differences from the comic book to the story as portrayed in the TV series, but that's all right. It's certainly the inspiration for the TV series. And I won't talk about the comic book, I'll just talk about the TV version. So as Perry mentioned, the basic idea is somehow, we never find out why, I don't think, on one particular day, a group of children is born around the world to women who haven't even been pregnant on the previous day. And suddenly these babies are being born. I think there's something like 40 or 45 of these babies are suddenly born for no particular reason. They're just born. And so there's an eccentric guy called Sir Reginald Hargreaves, and he tries to locate these children, and he's able to find and arrange to adopt 7 of these children. And he raises them and trains them in what he calls the Umbrella Academy to become a group of crime-fighting heroes, because they've all got these various special powers, superpowers, such as super strength, mind control, and so on. Talking to the dead is another one. So all these 7 kids have these powers, except one of them. We meet poor Vanya, who's quite ordinary, and has been told so throughout her childhood that she's the one who doesn't have any power. She's the ordinary one. She's nothing special about her. And she's been so embittered by this experience of being left out of everything as she grew up that when she grows up, she writes a best-selling tell-all book about her life growing up in the Hargreaves household, which kind of pisses off a number of the other people in the family. Anyway, as the series opens, the children have all grown up into adults, and this sort of crime-fighting era is past. They don't go out as a team anymore to fight crime. All but one of them have broken with their super-controlling, control-freak father and have left the family home, and they're living independent and, in some cases, fairly ordinary lives. One of them becomes a movie star. But they're brought back to the house when they're told their father's suddenly died. And so all the surviving children return, with 2 exceptions. One of their number was called Ben, and he had died as a child while on a crime-fighting mission. And the other, who we know only as 5, and I think we get to know his name, as 5, he disappeared at the age of 13 while trying to travel through time. So a lot of the series is about the relationships between all these grown-up ex-superheroes and their feelings about their lives and this unloving adoptive father. So they're sort of gathering together for his funeral and they're having these sort of fractured conversations with each other. And then 5 returns from the future telling them that there's an apocalypse which will destroy civilization and it's going to happen in only 5 days' time. And they have to get their act together as a superhero team to prevent it. So it's definitely too complicated a story, even just looking at one season, to try to describe all the details. But I just found the characters all really interesting. There's lots of quirky humour, there's lots of action, and there's some rather gory violence. There's some very moving emotional dilemmas in it. And it's overall has a very engaging story. Now, particularly in the first season, like the development arc of Vanya, this sort of mousy sort of person who she's turned her interest in music and she's become a violinist and a teacher of violin. And so we follow her, and all the time when she's in contact with her family, you sort of get this sense of, you know, she's the one that they don't pay much attention to, and you know, she doesn't have much to say, but that she slowly develops, and she then has a love interest comes to her, someone that she teaches violin to starts to become a friend and then a lover, but it doesn't turn out well. I just loved that arc of her development. It was really, really well done. And the second season, which is now, they actually end up being thrown back in time, and it's all set in Dallas, Texas, days before the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And one of the really good things in there, I think, is there's a really, really serious look at the treatment of Black Americans at the time and their struggles against racial segregation. And there's this harrowing scene where this Black community group stage a sit-in at a drugstore, and this drugstore's got signs up everywhere saying "whites only," which places like that did. And so they have the sit-in and then get abused, mercilessly abused by the white people. So it's like the TV series Watchmen. It really proves that you can have such media like this. It doesn't have to be media based on comic books, which doesn't have to be frivolous. It really can throw light on some serious and important issues, and I thought that was good. So I really like it. I judging by the comic book publications in Dark Horse, there's definitely scope for a third and maybe a fourth season based on the number of volumes of comic books that are available. Because season one is based on volume one of the comic book. Season two is based on volume two of the comic book. But there is a third and fourth volume of the comic book. So I'm hoping that Netflix decides to go ahead and continue. Because certainly the end of the second season is left up in the air too, isn't it? There's you think, what's going to go on now? What's going to happen next?
Yes, it certainly is. I actually liked the second season a bit more than the first. I mean, that isn't to say that I didn't like the first season. I did, but I thought that it was doing a lot of character setup and a lot of background setting up. So there was a lot of that. And so at times it can be a little bit slow in certain points, but you have to stick with it. And then in the second season, it just really kicks off and off she goes. Yep. One of the better things that I watched last year, I think I had both the two seasons in my top five of all time, or of the whole year, rather. And looking forward to another season of it. I will happily sit down and watch that. I think that if people are wondering, is it like X-Men or the Avengers? No, it's not.
No, it's not.
This is not big and flashy. This is just a family, basically.
Mm. It's much more character-based.
Much more character-based. Yeah. Much more that than special effects or big bangs or whatever. But they have big problems that they have to try and solve, but they are big problems that are impacting them directly, not the whole wide world or the universe, but just them and their area. Mm. And they have to deal with it and have to work on it. Good stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it was good stuff.
Recommend it. Yeah. Absolutely recommend it.
The next thing we wanted to talk about in this episode this is again a bit of a divergence, is that both Perry and I do quite a bit of work outside of the podcast and outside of reading books and watching TV series for the podcast. And so I thought we might talk about that. We've both talked briefly, I think, about it. I've certainly talked about some of the volunteer work I do. But what really, when you think about it, there's a lot of things that kept going on the internet because of volunteers, people volunteering their time and knowledge and skills to keep things going. I'm thinking of things like Wikipedia, which is a fantastic resource, which is entirely volunteer-based. They do ask for donations from time to time, but it's really all down to the volunteer work of people who are contributing and editing and making sure that things are right and continually keeping things up to date. There's the archive.org, again, which collects huge amounts of media and stores them away for future reference for people. I'm sure Perry could add a number of different things. But both he and I work on volunteer projects like those, and so I thought we might talk a bit about those. Now, I know that Perry does some work for Auslit. Is that right, Perry? What is it that you do for Auslit?
Yeah, well, just a bit of background. Auslit is the Australian Literature Bibliography. It's based out of the University of Queensland. And what they are attempting to do and have been attempting to do for the last 10 or 15 years or so, I'm not sure exactly how long it's been running, but it looks like maybe 20 years, because I've seen some of the records haven't been updated since 2003 or 4. Mm-hmm. So let's say the 21st century, sometime in there. Now, their aim is to make available to the general public and to universities and to libraries a full bibliography of Australian literature. Now, basically, this is a almost impossible task because a lot of material is not readily available, never been documented anywhere, or has been lost. So they're fully aware, though, I guess, that they are not going to get a complete and utter full set of everything that is going to be there. But they do want to be able to try and have as wide as possible a bibliography of Australian literature. Now, this just isn't straight books. This is any printed material that would be considered to be literature. So it's film scripts, it's plays, it's individual poems, short stories, novels, graphic novels, everything. So their aim is to try and get as wide a view as possible. It's one of these places, again, that is, well, lives off the smell of an oily rag, of course, because the universities, the governments, nobody around the place really sees much of a need for some of these things, although I'm assuming that the University of Queensland does actually have a need for it, because they've kept it going for this long, and they will keep it going, I would think. But you're not going to get much in the way of money from governments, because what do they need it for? And you think, well, what's the point in this? What do you need something like this for? Well, if you're going to basically do a survey of somebody's work, Madeline St. John, for example, I mean, that's not all that hard, because you're talking about 4 or 5 novels. You probably write a couple of short stories. They've probably got her full bibliography in there. But what happens if you've got somebody like Mabel Forrest, who not practically nobody in the universe knows anything about except me, it seems. She was a major Australian Queensland writer, a writer from Queensland, from around about 1880 until her death in about 1930. She'd been married early, got divorced or was widowed, left with no money, and realised the only way that she could make any money was by working as a writer. So she did a lot of work as a journalist, but also was a poet and a novelist. And she, I think we're up to somewhere in the vicinity of 2,500 individual items that she wrote.
Gosh.
And I'll be doing a lot of work on her stuff, and I'm nowhere near it, nowhere near finishing. Well, I'm probably halfway through. And so there's some of these people that you've got no idea the scope of what these people wrote and how much they wrote, unless you have a bibliography that you can get to and have a look at. Now, the part of the problem that people don't like about Auslit is that it is not free for use on the internet. You can get access to it if you go to any library in Australia, because they've made it free for those. So even if you're your local library, local suburban library, if you go down there and you want to look up, how many novels did Frank Hardy write, for example, you know, Power Without Glory, that bloke, how many did he write? You can go there and have a look at it, and you can get his full list of everything that they've got, but it's not complete. They can't guarantee that any of this stuff is complete unless people help them out and help them out doing this.
So you're helping them complete these bibliographies, but how do you do that? How do you find works by Mabel Forrest, and how do you prove that they're officially works by her that need to go into the system?
Well, let's go back to how I got started on this, and that'll probably give an indication of how it all sort of came together. As you know, and some of the people listening to this know, that I've got a big interest in the Australian writer C.J. Dennis. Dennis grew up in the same small country town that I did in South Australia, the small town of Laura, about 220 kilometres north of Adelaide at the bottom of the Flinders Ranges. And I just picked up an interest in him about, over the time, and just thought, well, it's from my hometown. I mean, why wouldn't I have a look at it? And then I started reading his stuff and really enjoyed it. And so then I was looking at it, looking at his stuff, and realised that there was a big gap in his... Well, I was looking his stuff up, trying to find out what stuff was around and whether all of his stuff had ever been brought together in single author collections or anthologised somewhere. And of course, a lot of this stuff hasn't been. It has never been seen by people other than the first publication.
Mm.
So I was looking in the State Library, and one of the state librarians pointed me towards Auslit. Said, "I'll go and have a look there. You'll probably find all the stuff that you're looking for there. You can get it for free here. You can access it for free." So I went and had a bit of a look. Had a look at all this stuff. I thought, oh, that's interesting. All that stuff's there. Maybe I should go back and have a bit of a look at it. So I started having a look at it, because he published a lot of things in the Bulletin magazine. So I had a bit of a look at that, and then I realised there was a whole lot of stuff in the Bulletin magazine which had never seen publication other than that first time. So all of the Bulletin magazine was on microfilm. You could basically have a look at it. So I was having a look at it, photocopying it, keeping it for my own interest, so that I can go back and have a look at it again. And I thought, well, what else has he done? And then I realised he'd done a whole lot of work as a editor of a couple of magazines in Adelaide, and then left Adelaide in about 1907 and moved to Melbourne to act as a freelance writer. And then there seemed to be a big bit of a gap. And I thought, well, how is this guy making his money? How was he earning a living? If the only thing that he really knew how to do was to write, how was he earning a living while he was living in Melbourne? Must have been producing stuff. And then I hunted around. Then I found out that a bloke by the name of McLaren, who was Speaker of the Lower House at one point in the Victorian Parliament, he was a Liberal MP, had done a large bibliography of Dennis's work. So I went and had a look at that and thought, oh, okay. Well, that's all right. There's still gaps. There's still this big gap of 3 or 4 years. So I thought he must have been trying to sell stuff to the newspapers or magazines in Melbourne. And I went hunting around in the Melbourne, the State Library of Victoria, to have a look and see what magazines were actually being published at that time. And came across the Melbourne version, or the Melbourne Punch. So this is basically like the London Punch, but it was published purely and simply in Melbourne. There was one in Adelaide, and I think for a while there was one in Sydney, all completely separate, but using the same sort of idea. They were sort of a weekly satirical, but also gossip-based, arts-based magazine, because, of course, at this time, we're pre-radio, certainly pre-television.
Yeah.
The only way that you were going to get entertainment was basically via the stage and reading things, and that was it. And so there was lots of reviews of theatre and so on and so forth. And I came across, oh, they started to publish poems in there. Well, Dennis must be in here. Oh, I'll have to go back and have a look at Auslit and see whether they've got it. They had nothing.
Uh-huh.
They had nothing in there about Punch. And I thought, well, there's this whole magazine that went on for like 30 years and nobody done anything. So I sort of looked down and I thought, well, how hard can this be? So I thought, I'll just start writing down what some of the contents are to see if I could. I'll just try and find whether Dennis was there. So I'm just looking through the microfilm and having a look. No, nothing here, nothing here. But I kept on coming across stuff and I thought, this stuff hasn't been documented. I better write it. So I kept on writing it down. Then I'd type it up. And then I contacted them and I Auslit, and I said, look, I've got this material that I've indexed. Would you like it? So I sent it to them and sent it to them and sent it to them. And after about 18 months of doing this, I reckon they got totally sick of it, David. I thought they just decided, oh, my God, will this guy just never go away? And so what they did was they said, look, why don't we just make it easier? Why don't we make you one of the volunteer editors for Auslit? And then you can enter the stuff directly.
That makes sense. Saves them you doing it.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I could just do it straight. No double handling, all that sort of stuff. And off we went. And so I started doing that. And I started finding, every now and again, I'd find, mainly in the Christmas issues of these magazines, I'd find a new piece by Dennis. But then I'd find other pieces by Edward Dyson. And he's another complete person that I could talk about. And then I started finding things by Zora Cross. A couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago now, I did a talk with Lucy Sussex about the new biography of Zora Cross. And I kept on finding a whole lot of her stuff that nobody had found before. And I kept on hunting around all over the place. And I kept on finding all of this stuff and putting it all in. And it was just got to be interesting and a real hobby. And it sort of basically helped me fill out the whole of the view of CJ Dennis. I think when we started, when I started working on it, CJ Dennis probably had 700 or 800 entries in Auslit. He's now just up under 2,000. And again, I think I'm probably only about halfway through. I've got a lot of work to do, and I don't do the work necessarily in a concentrated manner that I should do, David, because...
No, that's right. It's a volunteer job. That's right.
I've got other projects, like other people that come in and say, how would you like to do a podcast? But that's okay, because it's just one little project that I've got over here that I can do a bit of work on, and I can do a little bit of work on over there, and I can do a bit of work on over there. But what it does is it allows me also to... gives me an excuse to go in and have a look at old newspapers. Now, the material that I use to go through and dig in to try and find all of these poems and short stories and so on that have been published are either on microfilm in the State Library, where you have to basically thread it through the machine and you basically sort of just look at it at a screen, or on Trove. Now, Trove is an online database of digitised magazines and newspapers run out of the National Library of Australia. They have done a fair bit of work with a large number of newspapers digitising each of the pages, but some of the old pages are really quite not that flash, and so their digitisation... they also have a sort of an optical character recognition part of it. Yeah. So they've turned it into the images into text where they can. But there's a lot of the text which is just gobbledygook.
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
And it needs to be edited and fixed up. And so this is a crowdsourcing volunteer project where people, and there's something in the vicinity of 4,000 or 5,000 of us that have been in there and made, edited and amended the optical character recognition text for the newspapers. And so I've taken my CJ Dennis, Edward Dyson, Mabel Forrest, Zora Cross interest over into Trove and basically put that information in there. Every now and again, you come across something that nobody else has ever found.
Yes.
And sometimes it can be a bit scary, David.
Mm.
I've come across at least one piece by Henry Lawson that nobody knew existed. I've come across a couple of pieces by Banjo Patterson and quite a number of pieces by Adam Lindsay Gordon.
Mm.
Now, do you know who Adam Lindsay Gordon is?
Yes, yes, a poet.
You probably do. Our listener may not. Interestingly enough, Adam Lindsay Gordon is the only Australian poet with a bust and a memorial in Westminster Abbey in Poets' Corner. That's odd for a number of reasons, but also interesting as well. If you're in Melbourne, there is a Gordon Reserve at the top end of Collins Street, which has two statues on it. One of Adam Lindsay Gordon lying on a saddle, horse's saddle, because Adam Lindsay Gordon is not only a poet, he's in actually the Australian Racing Hall of Fame as a jockey.
Is that right? Goodness me, I didn't know that.
And the other person that is in that reserve is Gordon of Khartoum.
Oh, General Gordon of Khartoum.
General Gordon, who I believe was portrayed by, was it Charlton Heston?
Don't know.
In a film called Khartoum, I think, back from the 1950s. So he is there. Now, whether they're related or not, but they're both from the Gordon clan, which is why they probably basically ended up there in that reserve. But you start getting all these connections and you start finding things. But when you find something by somebody like that, who you think should really have been completely and utterly covered, because back in the 1980s, a couple of publishers, or one publisher in Australia, published a complete set of the Banjo Patterson works and a complete set of the Henry Lawson works. And when you find things that aren't in those, you get a bit scared because I think, no, this can't be right. I mean, it just can't be by this person. So what I do is I don't put it in there if I think that's the case. I actually send it off to my contact and say, could you check this for me, please, just in case?
Yeah, sir, you want a bit of a backup, yeah.
And they come back and said, oh, no, that looks right, but you have to put it in.
Yeah.
Because it's got to go in with your name.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So people can see that you're the one that's added it in. So I added it in, and that's just a nice little piece of kudos that you get internally. But this is work that I like doing. I find it very... It's not onerous. It just takes a little bit of time. But I think that in the end, what it does, it's sort of that concept of paying it forward.
Yes.
I'm reading stuff which I'm really enjoying. I'm utilizing the Auslit bibliography for my own ends, but I'm putting information into it and into Trove so that other people can come along afterwards and read stuff. And the lady that wrote the, whose name I've completely forgotten, who wrote the bibliography or the biography of Zora Cross, actually contacted me and thanked me very much for doing all the work in Trove.
Well, there you are, yeah.
Because she kept on saying, every time I came across things in Trove, there was your name on there having fixed it all up.
Yeah, now I see, there you are. It's good, you're making a difference. Mm.
But then what I do is, you see, I also indexed everything in Trove. I tag it so that you can say that it's a piece of poetry, it's by this particular person, and then it goes into a list with a list of all of their stuff, and then I note when it was done and when it was fixed and whether it's been indexed or not. Again, it's a situation of putting all this information in so that people further on down the track can get something out of it. And I just find this suits my interest in Australian poetry and Australian literature up to about the end of the Second World War, which is pretty much what Trove covers. It covers up to about mid-50s for the newspapers. It allows me to go back and have a look at old newspapers and see things. And you get a little bit, oh, look, here's a flood that I didn't know anything about. Or, oh, have a look over here. There's a murder mystery. Or, there's a cricket score. I'll go and have a read the cricket
Fair
stuff.
Enough.
So I'm going through old newspapers, and occasionally you get sidetracked. But that's okay. I've got time. As a retired gentleman, I've got time to be able to do that and to sit back and to enjoy it. And I try to explain this to a lot of people, and they go, what are you doing that for? But it's volunteer work. And when you get to volunteer work, sometimes it's impossible to be able to really state to somebody why you're doing it, other than the fact that it gives you a good feeling and puts effort back into the community in which you feel as though you are a part.
Yeah.
And I think that's vitally important. And I know you do this sort of thing as well.
Yeah, well, that's right in a different sort of way. But, I mean, that's right. Really, it's all about keeping your brain active, which I think is pretty important.
Oh, yes.
And contributing, as you say, contributing to the community. So, yeah, no, the work that I do the volunteer work I do is mainly to do with standard e-books, which I've talked about many times on the podcast. So,
yeah, okay, but how did you get started with standard? I know sort of the work that you do with it.
Yeah.
But how did you come across it in the first instance? And how did you get started?
That's interesting. And one of the blogs that I follow is called Daring Fireball, and it's run by a guy called John Gruber, it tends to be about Apple stuff and Apple computers and Apple phones and Apple iPads and all that sort of stuff. But he talks about a good many other things. Anyway, just one day when I looked it up, there was this mention of this thing called standard ebooks, and he'd come across it from a reference from Hacker News, I think. And he talked about the project and what it was about. And I thought, and that they were looking for volunteers to help. And I sort of looked at it and thought, this is the kind of thing that I could really do well, because they were looking for people who were interested in literature or in fiction or in writing, looking for people who had some technical skills to do with knowing your way around HTML, those sort of skills. And I thought, yeah, I could help with this. And so I got in contact with the guy who runs it, the guy who set it up is a guy called Alex Cabell. And in fact, I've got an interview with him, which we'll get to later on in this episode. And sort of said, oh, look, I've got these sorts of skills, you know, can I help in any way? And so I said, yeah, sure, just pick a book that you'd like to see. Here's a they have had a list of wanted books or books that they were asking people to look at. And he said, yeah, start with something simple and see how you go. And so I actually, on the list, wanted list, was a book called The Cosmic Computer by H. Beam Piper. For reasons that are a bit complicated to go into, everything that H. Beam Piper wrote in the 1950s as a science fiction writer, 1950s and 1960s, ended up in the public domain. Long story, but he ended up in the public domain. So this was one of the books that was in the public domain. And so I tackled that one. I think, in fact, that when I first started out, I wanted to do some books by Wilkie Collins, who is my favourite Victorian era writer, one of my favourite Victorian era writers. But Alex said, no, look, start with something simpler. And so I picked on The Cosmic Computer and did that. And, God, I made so many mistakes. I kept going backwards and forwards with Alex, and he's saying, no, you got this wrong. You know, the CSS here isn't working properly, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. And that was actually before there was an official manual. So it was really all just Alex saying, you know, no, you need to do it in this particular way. And at that stage, I really didn't. I knew a fair bit. I mean, I'd been a software developer for decades, and so I knew my way around writing code. But I was never that much of a web developer, and so I didn't know a lot of the subtleties of HTML, and I certainly didn't know very much about CSS, cascading style sheets. I knew a little bit.
They're very complicated.
Yeah, I was completely ignorant of regular expressions, which I'll talk about in a sec, and a whole lot of stuff. And the other thing was Git. What we do is the books that we produce, or the things that we produce, we put the source code of that up in a public version on a thing called GitHub, which is basically where people generally post software, but it can be used for any sort of purpose. And the advantage of that is as you make changes to your project, you keep committing various versions of that. And because it's a public system, people can see what you've put up. They can suggest changes to it, and so on. So, and that's the core part. And I knew nothing about Git. I'd used, I think, one source control system before that, but I had so many stumbles to do with Git in the first place. Anyway, I'm making this a long story, but basically, I struggled through the first project, and managed to get it together. And eventually, it was released as a book. I haven't actually talked about the philosophy of standard ebooks, but we'll leave that to Alex, I think, to talk about in the interview. But anyway, it's basically to get these public domain books in a nice, beautifully formatted, standardized form and available to the public for free. And so that was the thing. So yeah, I struggled through my first project, and then eventually I moved on to. I think I'm not quite sure what the next book was I did. I think I wanted to get into Wilkie Collins. And so probably my third project, something like that, was a Wilkie Collins book. And the trouble with Wilkie Collins is that he actually wrote he put together very complicated structures to his books, in that, you know, you've got, I think one of the books I did early was a book called No Name by Wilkie Collins. And he's got these various scenes, like he talks about scene number one, scene two, scene three, and then in between that, it's got something called between the scenes, and it has this like deeply nested structure to it. So it was actually quite a complicated book to do. So, but anyway, I got through it, and a lot of it was letters, you know. So I got early into doing letters for this project,
which came in useful later on
which came in very useful recently when I finished doing Clarissa. But basically, I learnt a huge amount by doing the project, and really kept my brain going, and that's been very good. And so I may not be an expert, but I'm now very good at using regular expressions. Are you familiar with regular expressions? They're a pattern matching a system for pattern matching text. So if you want to find all the words that begin with CAT, for example. But you only want the cases where it appears at the start of a line, or where the next two characters are numerals, or, you know, you can build these very complicated patterns. There's a bit of a joke about regular expressions that goes around, and that's that if you're a programmer and you're writing some program, and you suddenly you come across a problem and you think, I could solve it with regular expressions. The joke is, now you've got two problems. Because now you've got to work your way out of solving the regular expression. But no, but it's incredibly powerful anyway, and you can use it also to replace. And so we do, certainly with standard ebooks, I do a lot of searching and replacing in very, you can do very, very complex things with it. It's tremendously powerful, but also tremendously dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And so that's one of the advantages of using this source control system. So if you actually completely messed something completely up, you can revert back to where you were before you started. So yeah, anyway, it's the secondary advantage of it to me is that it's introduced me to a lot of English literature that I would normally probably not ever have come across, not that I wouldn't have come across, but I probably would never have been motivated to read, because a lot of this public domain work, of course, is that sort of classic literature written in the 1800s or early 1900s. And just seeing what was on the wanted list and seeing books that looked interesting has sort of introduced me to writers like George Eliot, for example, and a number of other authors who I wouldn't otherwise have perhaps come across. So that's been a good thing too.
So how many people around the world do you think are working as a volunteer on standard ebooks?
Well, it varies, and there's a number of core people who do a lot of work. As always in these kind of situations, there's a core group of people who do a lot of work. There's probably, I'd say, probably six or seven people who you know, sort of really dedicated, among whom I would include myself. And in fact, I'm on the editorial board now. But so, yeah, so maybe a couple of dozen people contribute on a reasonably regular basis. A number of people sort of come in. We've had quite a few people come in and say, I want to do a project and start, and then find it too hard and give up and don't
disappear,
get back again.
Yeah.
But again, that's par for the course, this sort of thing. So quite often projects are abandoned and then someone else comes along later and they can pick that up and generally start from scratch rather than try to, you know, reconstruct where someone else has been working. But so there's probably over the time, I imagine there's probably been 100 different producers, but there is a core group who do a lot of work and a sort of wider group who do less regular work, I suppose.
It's similar to what happens with Wikipedia, which you mentioned at the start of this. I did a lot of work on Wikipedia for 8 to 10 years, doing a lot of work on Australian literature, and sort of fell out of love with it after I kept on having to fight too many battles.
Oh, yes.
I kept on losing. And I got a little bit sick of it. I'm on one of those ones for Wikipedia who's an inclusionist, in that if I think that it is, if a topic or subject is of interest to even a small group of people, then it should be of interest or available for everybody. I don't think that you can basically go in and sort of say, no, this is not of interest. Well, it's only of interest to 20 or 30 people. Well, that's 20 or 30 people.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
That's a lot. Because there are some things where in the world where, you know, there's not all that many, not even that many people that are interested in things, but they're still up there. And so you get the inclusionists on one hand, which I was, and the exclusionists. And the exclusionists have a tendency to go in and try and just get rid of stuff that they don't want. And they spend all their energy getting rid of things. Well, why don't you just bloody leave it there and just build your own? But no. All they want to do is they just want to knock stuff down.
Yeah, that's right. There's no limit on the size it can be.
And after a while, you get to the point where you think, I'm fighting more battles trying to save things than I am putting new stuff up. And so I gave it up. I dropped back in just recently and discovered that a certain American fan who had a Peggy Ray Sapienza, who was a friend of mine and a very, very well-known and well-respected fan around the world, and a Worldcon chair, had somebody had basically decided that her page was of no importance. It had 20 or 30 references to other material. It was quite well done and but that person just didn't like it. So put it up for deletion. And of course, if you don't know about it, the way that the Wikipedia works, if some person says, I don't want this, so I'm going to delete it. And they put it up for debate and nobody debates and nobody comes through. And in the end, they can just say, oh, well, the only consensus is this one person who doesn't want it and nobody's come to defend it. And so it disappears. And you think, this is terrible. This is not the way to run a bloody encyclopedia. But that's what happens in Wikipedia. And so I fell out of love with it. But they also have another side project to that called Wikisource, which does similar things to standard ebooks, but puts it all up on an HTML up on a screen. I think your idea of putting it up as ebooks so that you can actually download it to an e-reader and read it as if it fits on your Kindle or your rereader of whatever format you've got, I think that's an excellent way of doing things. And I think that makes this stuff available is a really good way of... It's a good use of your time, David, in my view.
But
for a lot of us, these are things like this stuff is like hobbies. Hobbies are, to me, people say, well, why are you doing it? What are you getting out of it? I'm getting enjoyment out of it. And that's all you need. So we have an enjoyment about reading science fiction. We have an enjoyment about talking about it. Does it get us anywhere? Not really.
It doesn't matter.
Do we enjoy it? Absolutely we do. Sure. We can have great arguments about it. And it's just fun. Mm. That's all you need from a hobby. Yes, it's going to cost you a bit of money. That's okay. It's going to cost you a bit of money and a bit of time. That's what hobbies are for. And if it makes you feel better in your life in terms of what you're doing, even if it's just this warm inner glow, that terrible cliched warm inner glow, who gives a rat's? As long as it's working for you and it's what you want to do, I think all power to you. Just keep on going. I enjoy the stuff I'm doing with Trove and the indexing for Auslit. I drop into it and occasionally I do a big burst of it for days on end, and other days it'll be half an hour here or an hour there. If I've got other things going on, I won't do anything for a while. Then there's a bit of a lapse and I go, oh, yeah, okay, I'll do a bit of work there. It's great. And I think that they're all very, very useful things. And I'm just very glad that people have got these things set up on the internet that you can go and do. I mean, there's a whole heap of other things that I would have liked to have gotten involved in.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of potential.
I mean, there was that big project a number of years ago about... identifying elliptical and spiral galaxies.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Well, I would have loved to have done that. Yeah. I didn't have the time.
No, that's right. You're too busy doing other stuff.
So you get to the point where you've got so many things that you've got on your plate that you don't actually have time to do some of the things you want to do. Mm. So, anyway, that's okay. Yep. It's good stuff.
All right. Thanks for that. Well, yeah, now I actually recorded an interview a few days ago with Alex Cavell, who's the chap in charge of Standard eBooks, and he's got quite a few interesting things to say about how he started that project, how it came about, and where its future lies. So we'll go to that now. I'm talking today with Alex Cavell, who's the founder and the editor-in-chief of Standard eBooks, which is a voluntary organisation dedicated to producing beautiful, well-formatted eBooks of classic works of literature. That's the whole philosophy behind the organisation, I think, but I'll talk to Alex and get him to explain in better terms. So, Alex, just a bit of a background about yourself first. How did you... Where did you grow up and how did you come to where you are today?
Well, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and spent, you know, my youth there. And then I went to university in California in Los Angeles. I studied computer science and English. I did both, a minor in English. And after university, I went into a job as a computer programmer, a web developer, and I didn't quite like the sort of, you know, 9-to-5 situation, so I decided to start my own business, which is what Scribblefile is, my main sort of source of income. Mm-hmm. And after that, I took the opportunity to work remotely. This is probably 13 or 14 years ago, so it was not nearly as common as it is today. And so I was one of the very early, I guess you could call them digital nomads that now you hear about all the time. Well, I was doing that 13, 14 years ago, kind of one of the few people doing it at the time. And so I spent a lot of time traveling through Europe, through Australia, New Zealand, Asia, other places, South America. And once I felt like I was done with that, I came to Chicago, where a lot of my family lives.
Uh-huh.
And I decided to settle down there. And so I've been here for a while now in Chicago.
So what gave you the idea of starting Standard eBooks? We'll talk a little bit later about Scribophile, which I also know of. But what was the impetus to start Standard eBooks, which I think you've described as a hobby?
Yeah, it's basically a hobby right now. I mean, we only recently started accepting donations for U.S. citizens, a deductible tax basis. But, you know, it's not like there's a huge amount of money coming in. So it's definitely still on the hobby level. And I started it because when I was traveling, I was living in Germany for a while, a couple years or a year or two. And it was very difficult to find English language books there. You had to be in a big city, and I wasn't in the big city.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had my e-reader at the time. I think it was a Nook at the time. And I started buying books from the Amazon store, from the Nook store, and the formatting was just really bad on all of them. Again, this was probably more than 8 years ago, probably 10 or so years ago. And at the time, a lot of the back catalog books that they had, even major publishers, a lot of the back catalog books they had for sale were just bad OCR, optical character recognition transcriptions.
Yeah.
And so they'd be filled with typos and errors. And so I'd be sitting there really mad. That I read, you know, you're paying a lot of money for this book that is not really very good quality at all. You would never print this on paper. It would be embarrassing.
Yeah.
So I started correcting them for my own library, not to distribute, but just for myself, because I've bought these books and may as well keep a nice edition for myself.
Yeah.
And then over time, I decided to download some stuff from Project Gutenberg, because everyone knows that, you know, it's a great source for a huge variety of classic literature and other public domain literature. And so I started downloading those eBooks and transferring them to my e-reader. And I realized that although they weren't at the level of raw OCR, they were fairly good quality in terms of typos and stuff like that, but they were clearly not formatted for what an e-reader can do.
No.
And so you were reading these books that the typography of them was more akin to a web page than it was to a print book, even though you're reading them on an e-ink device that's supposed to be like a print book.
Yeah.
So I took the sort of starting, jumping off point that I had with, you know, doing my best to edit these commercial e-books for my own library. And I said to myself, well, why don't I just do this for these public domain books? And the benefit of doing it for public domain books is that I can just give them away again.
Yeah.
I can set up a website and distribute them, and then everyone can enjoy these well-produced books that I was doing for myself. But really, anyone would be interested in getting a copy that is produced to this kind of standard.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I got started. And I had been doing them for myself for maybe a year, just kind of on and off, before I decided to sit down and set up a website and start distributing them officially. You know, I set up the website probably, I want to say, 6 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that. And it got featured on Hacker News, which brought a lot of traffic. It got all over Reddit and a bunch of blogs and, you know, news outlets and stuff. And everyone seemed to really like the project. And so from then on, I just kind of decided to make a hobby out of it. And here we are, many years later, and hundreds of ebooks later, and hundreds of contributors from all over the world later.
Well, indeed, that's right.
It's become a very big, big and sort of, I'd say, successful effort that people enjoy. So I'm very proud of that.
Oh, I think you should have a great deal to be proud of. You're coming up to nearly 500 books, I think, on the site.
Yes.
Yeah, which is interesting in a sense. It's a mixture of books of different origins, different genres. They're all public domain books. But what was it that? How did you decide which books you were going to start to work on? And what was the choice of the first few books you decided to work on as official Standard eBooks productions?
Well, the original books were basically ones that I wanted to read for myself. So it was all kind of within my own personal taste of things that are interesting. I think the very, very first I don't remember which one is the very first one, but the very early ones were Dracula, The Enchiridion by Epictetus, which nowadays we'd probably put in a compilation, but because it was one of the very first ebooks that we made, it's just kind of on its own now. It's very short. Some other ones were Princess of Mars. That was one of the early ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Books like that. And so they're kind of all over the place, kind of a span of philosophy and classic fiction, and then also whatever modern, I personally enjoy science fiction a lot, and whatever kind of modern fiction we can fit in that is still public domain.
Hmm.
I wish people wouldn't call them classics, because that's not always the case.
No.
We definitely do have a lot of classics that you could consider books that are the kinds of books that you might read in school, or that everyone has read at some point, or they have some kind of cultural influence. But a lot of the books we do they're all public domain, but they can be a lot newer. So we have a lot of sci-fi books on there from the 50s and even 60s that fell into U.S. public domain for various reasons. There's some other modern stuff on there, and also a lot of more obscure stuff that I wouldn't call classics at all. Just because they're old doesn't mean they're classic.
No, that's true.
You know, I mean, they're philosophy books or, you know, other fiction books that became obscure for whatever reason, but are still very interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have all kinds of books on there, and our wanted list originally was books that I wanted to read. So my hope with that wanted list was other people would do the hard work for me, and then I could sit down and read the books.
Yeah.
But as I've been working on this project, you know, people are pulling those books off the list faster than I can read them. And then I'm also reading my own books that I produce for the project. So I've realized that I'm never going to have time to read any of these books anyway. So
that's right. It's getting to the stage where it'd be pretty tough to read the entire catalog. That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's pretty out of the question, I think, at this point.
Yeah. That's right. So I guess really the books that are chosen to work on, really it's up to the individual producer, isn't it, to decide what they want to work on.
Right.
And so it's their individual tastes that get reflected in the catalog.
Exactly right. So Standard eBooks has a collections policy of a sort, which is we basically accept all kinds of fiction. We try to maintain compilations of shorter work where possible. So if someone like H.P. Lovecraft, which wrote a lot of short horror stories, instead of having each one as an individual ebook, we just compile them into one omnibus of all of his short fiction, so you don't have to go scrabbling around and downloading 100 different files. And then we accept some what I call timeless nonfiction, which is things like philosophy and some autobiography, like a limited set of biography, that kind of thing. I think that's about it. And then we accept, you know, plays and that sort of thing that kind of falls under the fiction genre. But as you said, it's basically whatever the producer personally wants to produce, that's what they work on, because they have to read it. So they have to have an interest in reading it.
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of times that means committing to a really long book. And if they're not interested, then why bother?
Yes, that's right. Well, having just completed one of the longest works in English literature, Clarissa Harlowe, the case, I don't think I ever would have read it if it hadn't been for this project.
That's right, you did. You know, I looked at the word count of that on the website, and it's almost twice as long as War and Peace. That's how long that book is.
Yeah, it's a pretty long book, and yet it is a single work. Yeah,
that's it's a very impressive that you finished that. I'm very impressed. So we're very happy to have it in the catalog.
I'm glad too, but I'm glad to have finished. But I'm also glad to have read it. It was a very good book. So anyway, I don't think I ever would have read it other than and doing it for the project. But the other thing I guess is that you do. Producers like myself do discover books this way, because I don't think I'd read any George Eliot before I came to Standard eBooks, and I thought, looking through the list of best books in one of those Guardian lists of the best books in English, Middlemarch by George Eliot, that sounds like it's been, you know, people think it's pretty good, and so I did that, and that's how I came to discover George Eliot, and I'm really glad I did. She's a terrific writer. Anyway, it's good.
Yeah, actually, I haven't had much of a chance to read George Eliot, so Middlemarch is definitely something that was probably on the wants list at some point, but now is still on my personal to-read list eventually once I get around to it.
Sure, yeah. Well, I'd go for that rather than The Mill on the Floss is a little bit dull, I think, but Middlemarch is pretty good, yeah. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you was about the look of the books. There's a very distinct look because you've emphasised the idea of making really good-looking covers, and there's a certain approach that you've taken. Do you want to talk about that look of the books and how you came to decide on that and how you maintain that policy?
Sure. We all of our covers are drawn from art that is also in the public domain, usually like fine art, oil painting style art. So as I was doing these ebooks for myself, I was thinking that, you know, obviously the cover is a big part of a book, and a lot of these books that you download from Project Gutenberg, which was where I was originally downloading them from, have these auto-generated covers that, in my opinion, are not very attractive. They're just kind of these random geometric shapes and very bright and kind of garish colors, and then the author and book title are kind of like on there and with not a whole lot of thought to positioning or layouts. And anyway, I said to myself, maybe we can do something nicer. And if we're already working on public domain books, why not try to find public domain art that would kind of match the theme of the book? And that's kind of the general style of the covers. Each producer is required to find a public domain fine art painting that in some way reflects the contents of the book. And that just becomes the cover. And then we have a very simple black square with the title and author under that, and that's the same position for all the books. And so it becomes, you know, just like the name of the project, it becomes kind of a standard where you see this cover that's kind of like a fine art painting, and then that black square with that particular font and the name of the book and author, and then you can say, oh, that's probably a standard ebooks ebook.
Yeah, they certainly look very stylish.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, as much as it came around, you know, there's not a big science to it. I just kind of sat down one day and said, this would look kind of nice. And so I've been a web designer for a long time, and I wouldn't say I'm a, you know, especially gifted, you know, arts kind of person. I'm not so much into like the graphic design arena, but, you know, I spent a lot of time working on these websites. So I think, you know, part of that came from there, where you just kind of have an eye on margins and paddings and what kind of looks attractive and what doesn't, and people seem to like the covers. So,
Yeah, absolutely. They're certainly a very distinctive and a very attractive look to them. Each of the books that you produced, you release or dedicate to the public domain. That was obviously a philosophy right from the start. Is that because the material starts in the public domain? I mean, other organizations or other people might think, oh, I can make money out of doing this. But you obviously decided that wasn't the approach.
Yes, well, I don't think there's a lot of money in public domain ebooks, honestly. There's just, if you go on Amazon and you search for Dracula, there's like 5,000, you know, crappy editions that someone has put together for an ebook. So, and they're all free or like 99 cents.
Yeah.
So there's not a huge money in public domain ebooks. I would say public domain print books, there might be some market. Places like Dover, for example, make money off that.
Oh, that's true.
You know, you can make educational editions or annotated editions like Penguin Classics or something like that. And so that's a different story. But as far as ebooks goes, I never thought there was going to be any money in it. And there hasn't been. As far as the public domain dedication goes, the contents of the book themselves are already in the U.S. public domain. So it's not like our dedication changes that in any way. Even if we had sat down and said, oh, we've copyrighted everything. Well, we really haven't, because we don't own the rights to the work to begin with. It's already in the public domain. But what we do is we release the entire ebook under the Creative Commons Zero license, which is basically a public domain. And the ebook itself includes things like metadata that our producers write descriptions of the books. They arrange things like colophons and imprints, which were our editions and are not part of the original public domain text. So all that stuff that our producers produce is in theory copyrighted by them or by the organization. And so we release all that to the public domain so that we can say that this entire ebook file from start to finish, everything included, is at least in the U.S. public domain, if not the worldwide public domain.
So obviously this project's grown and grown since you began it 5 or 6 years ago. What do you see as the challenges for standard ebooks as we go into the future?
I think the big challenge is going to be finding funding. We've like I mentioned earlier, we've just started to accept donations on a tax deductible basis. in December. So really just a few months ago, we're talking February right now of 2021. And the getting donations is important because this is becoming an increasingly time-consuming project. I'm spending a lot of time doing management work for coordinating all of these volunteers through all these various stages of books. And even though I have a lot of help from our experienced producers like yourself, David, and a few other people, there's still a lot of time spent in just coordinating the project. You know, someone might ask a question in the mailing list saying something like, you know, oh, this line has this kind of punctuation and I'm not sure what to do about it. And that simple question might be a one-sentence answer, but getting that answer out could take an hour because you have to go and look through the book. You have to see, is this kind of a special case? You have to do some research sometimes. And so even if I reply back with like one or two words, you know, it could have taken me an hour to write that email.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just adds up during the day. And I have a full-time job anyway. I mean, I run a business, and so it's not like I have, you know, 100% free time. And so that's the big challenge of the organization is being able to be funded in a way where I could make this a full-time job and start hiring other people to take on some of this workload on a basis that's not just a volunteer basis.
Yeah.
Because while volunteers are very good and all, I think a really healthy organization survives off of people who can dedicate their entire time to it.
Yeah.
So that's what I like to do.
Yeah. And there must be some other actual fixed costs like hosting and bandwidth, all those sorts of things.
Exactly right. So, I mean, I've been paying hosting costs out of pocket all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not a huge amount, but I mean, it's not nothing.
No.
And, you know, we have, you know, I would also like to spend time on developing the infrastructure of the ebook production process. Right now we're on a Google Groups mailing list, and that makes me really nervous because Google can pull the plug as they do at any time on any of these products. And then, you know, they could say we're shutting down groups and then a month later you're stuck. So it's infrastructure things like getting our own mailing list software going, getting some kind of project management solution going so we have a better way to manage these projects than just one thread on a mailing list, setting up a public domain art clearinghouse. One of the most complicated and time-consuming tasks that for all of our ebook producers is finding art, because you have to prove it's in the public domain, and that's a complicated process. So having a single clearinghouse where you could say all the art here has been verified by us to be acceptable for use would be a huge time saver for a lot of people. But putting that together is also a huge project. It's not something you can do in a month.
No,
so
right.
all these things require money or time, and I don't have either of those right now. So once we start getting money in, then we can start addressing all these things to, you know, improve the organization, improve the production process, help our producers, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly hope that comes about. Before we go, I just thought perhaps you might like to talk about your other projects, like Scribophile, and what's this another one? I think is there. Or?
Yeah, Scribophile is my sort of main business. I've been running it for 13, 14 years now, kind of a long time, and it's basically a online writing community where writers sign up and then they post a work in progress and other writers give them advice on how to improve it. So it's a critique-based writing community. And we're one of the largest independent writing communities online. We have, you know, a whole lot of members, and our members have been writing, you know, a novel's worth of critiques every day, basically. You know, hundreds of thousands of words of critique are written every day, helping each other improve. And that's kind of what I've been working on. It's my day job. It takes up time to maintain and to manage. It's a large community, so a lot of people have a lot of various problems that they need to get sorted out over the course of a day, and that's what I spend a lot of my time on when I'm not working on standard ebooks. And Writerfolio is a smaller business that provides online sort of, I would call them portfolio websites for freelance writers. So if you're a freelance writer and you want to show off your work, then instead of getting a WordPress site, which could be very complicated, it could require a lot of customization, a lot of time consuming trying to get your website just right, You can come to Writerfolio, and we have various templates that you can fill out very quickly that are specifically geared to helping writers show off their work. So those are the two things that that sort of keep a roof over my head.
All right. Well, thanks, Alex. That's been really interesting, and it's a great project, and I've certainly personally have enjoyed enormously being part of it once I discovered it a few years ago. So thanks very much for that.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to have you as a contributor. You've done a lot of great work to not just produce ebooks, but also to advance the project itself. So I'm very grateful, and it's been an honor to know all of these interesting and talented people from all over the world that are, I've only met you in person, but all these other people, I feel like I almost know them because we interact so much on a daily basis and we get so much good work done. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Indeed. So thanks for that, Alex, and I'll look forward to continuing to work for Standard eBooks. So I think that's about it, Perry. We've been talking for a while here, and we've had an interview there, so we're well into the hour and a half period, I think, of this length of this thing. So.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
People need things to be able to listen to while they're going out on their daily constitutional.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that's a good thing. We're a little bit uncertain as to what we're doing next time.
Yes.
We have a couple of possibilities for what it's going to be, but we're feeling a bit more laid back about things now, David, and we'll figure it out in the next couple of weeks. If it just gets down to us talking about what books we've been reading lately, that'll be
so
fine.
Be it. Yep, nothing
wrong. Or if we talk to a couple of other people about what they've been reading, that may also be fine. And we'll just figure out what that's going to be when the time comes.
Indeed.
All right. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks' time. All right.
All right.
Thanks, Perry.
See you then.
See you.
Bye.
Bye.